Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, the Food and Drug Administration approved the first cell-based gene therapy in the United States. The cell-based gene therapy is called CAR-T, and it uses a patient's immune system to attack cancer. The therapy is expected to treat children and young adults who have an aggressive form of leukemia and who otherwise fail to respond to treatment. The price tag? $475,000. Joining us by phone to talk about it is the director of the Cellular Therapy and Cancer Immunotherapy Program at Nationwide Children's Hospital and the Ohio State Comprehensive Cancer Center, Dr. Dean Lee. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
The FDA is calling this historic, the first of its kind. In your world, how big of a deal is it?
This is a very big deal, not only because of the nature of the therapy being something that is adding back your own immune system, but also that immune system has been genetically modified. Those are two big deals in the FDA's eyes. But it's also a big deal in just the breadth of our therapeutic the things that we have that are available, in that it's a very different kind of therapy than we've ever had for cancer.
Well, tell us about the therapy, how it actually works.
So first, just a little bit about your immune system and what these cells are. T cells are a specific part of white blood cells that we have in our blood, that their typical job is to take care of viral infections. And they do this by recognizing proteins that are considered foreign to your body. So if you have influenza, one of the primary responses that you have in your immune system is T cells that recognize influenza, go in, and their job is to kill all the cells that are infected with the virus so that the virus can no longer propagate. And the T cells are very often also what we're trying to train when we give someone an immunization. Mm-hmm. So we give you a vaccine for chickenpox. We are trying to pre-train your T cells to recognize chickenpox so that when you encounter it, you have a much faster response and you get over it sooner. So the problem with using that those cell types for cancer is that cancer is our own tissue. And it's often hard for those T cells to recognize anything foreign about it. There are some parts of it that are foreign that can be recognized, but in some diseases we do that not very well. So to use those cells, your very powerful cells in your own immune system, to be able to attack cancer, what they had to do was find a way to modify the cells with a new gene that would force those cells to be able to recognize leukemia. And in this case, it recognizes a particular protein that is on the surface of almost all pediatric B-cell acute leukemias called CD19. And by engineering the T-cells to see CD19, they now think that all of the leukemia cells are foreign and aggressively attack it.
Why is this particularly helpful for youth and children, young adults and children? Why is it because that aspect of the cell is more, or that protein is more prevalent in the leukemia when it attacks them?
It's more that kind of leukemia is more prevalent in children.
Gotcha.
So there are multiple types of B cell cancers, and adults tend to more often get B-cell lymphomas. Adults can also get the B-cell leukemias, but the most profound responses to this therapy have been seen in the pediatric leukemia setting, and it's also being used in adult lymphomas, but I think to their credit, this particular company decided that they were going to make their initial licensing indication with the FDA be a pediatric disease, because that's where they saw the greatest responses.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Dr. Dean Lee of the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center, the Arthur G. James Cancer Hospital, and Richard J. Soloff Research Center about the FDA's historic decision to approve the first cell-based gene therapy in the United States. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why is it so expensive? The number I mentioned was $475,000. When I was preparing for this, I read about much higher numbers, depending on the cases.
Yeah, so it's a complicated, it's part business and it's part reality. This is a unique therapy in the sense that it is custom made for every patient. The process requires that you take a patient who has cancer and you isolate from them their own T cells, which is sometimes difficult in patients who have leukemia because their blood is overrun with leukemic cells. Finding those healthy T cells can be difficult. And then those T cells have to be genetically modified and grown for a while so that they are enough in number, and then shipped back to the treating institution where they are then infused. So we don't have any other examples of something that's such a complicated manufacturing process. And certainly as a live cell, this is never going to be the kind of therapy that can be put in a bottle and stuck on a pharmacy shelf. So the logistics of all of this manufacturing and shipping and making sure that the right product gets to the right patient, all those issues are really enormously expensive. The other consideration for the price is the fact that it is so extremely effective that there are patients who have been placed into complete remission with a single dose for years, and that it has the potential for taking the place of many other therapies and many longer-term therapies.
Why does that mean it's more expensive?
To be as kind about it as possible,
sure.
It is in part a business decision that if you could replace something as aggressive and costly as bone marrow transplant, which costs several hundreds of thousands of dollars, with a single dose of a cell therapy, that then should make it equivalent in terms of value to the public and to the customer. So, there's been a lot of argument about whether or not that's the right approach. Mm-hmm. Certainly I haven't been on the inner circle of any of those discussions.
Mm-hmm.
But I do understand that one of the ways that they negotiated this as a price was to commit to only charging if the therapy actually worked.
Ah.
So although it is a tremendous price tag, the patients will not be billed if they make the cells and the cells fail to put them into remission.
Let me ask you this. Why do you have to use the patient's cells? Could there be sort of, other cells that could be more adaptable than some?
Sure. And there are several groups that are working on that. There was actually one group that had a trial that was just recently put on hold that is trying to get around that, trying to make what they would call a universal cell or an off-the-shelf cell product. The main problem is that it's a foreign cell. It's a cell from another person mm-hmm. that has the ability both to attack your own tissue and the ability to be attacked by your immune system. So there's a problem of rejection, that your own immune system would reject the cells, and a problem of something called graft versus host disease, or that the cells would attack your body. If they're your own T cells, you don't have that problem. So there are ways of getting around that, but they're going to take us a little longer and have their own complications.
As these kinds of therapies develop, because I figure this is just the start, of this kind of therapy, the cell-based gene therapy, is it going to be something that people envision in the future that we'll set aside some of our own blood for these kinds of therapies if something should happen?
It's a good question. I think the best answer is probably around the same idea for transplant.
Hmm.
that although transplant is a very effective therapy for some types of diseases, we've gotten away from banking our own cells in general, because for those cases where we would use our own cells in what we'd call an autologous transplant, they are relatively easy to collect when you actually need them.
Okay.
And for those where you need your own cells and you can't collect them, like in the case of banking your own cord blood, do you want to save your own child's cord?
Mm-hmm.
The official recommendation from the National Marrow Donor Program is that you are more likely to benefit as a community just to donate that to a bank and not necessarily reserve it for yourself. The likelihood that you're actually going to use your own cord is very, very small.
What are the side effects of CAR T cell therapy? Are there any?
Yes, and they're actually very different from our current therapy, which is good and bad. So the good news is it doesn't have the same kind of toxicity that causes long-term complications that are currently associated with chemotherapy and radiation, especially in children where we're worried about radiation causing stunting of their growth, later endocrine problems, secondary cancers, et cetera. And chemotherapy is quite toxic to other parts of the body, including the heart and the liver. It has its own problem with secondary cancers as well. But so it doesn't have those toxicities, but what it does have is a profound immune response that probably the best analogy would be it's like getting the worst case of the flu that you ever had.
Mm.
It is enough to make your blood pressure drop, to serious enough to actually have to go to the intensive care unit. Can make the blood vessels in your body very leaky, which can leak fluid into your lungs. In fact, the very first patient who was treated with this was so sick, they really expected her to die of the toxicity. She didn't, and they found a particular way to control that one part of the toxicity with another drug called tocilizumab. And so she survived the therapy and is now, I think, close to five years after being cured and doing very well. It doesn't happen in all patients, and this particular toxicity is called cytokine release syndrome. But when it does happen, it can be quite severe. There's also been a few toxicities related to these cells that have been neurologic toxicities, and they have been harder for us to understand why they happen, and also harder for us to find treatments for. They also, fortunately, happen to be much, much more rare and have not happened with all of the different CARs. There have been some that have had neurotoxicities and some that haven't.
Dr. Dean Lee, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Very welcome.
Dr. Dean Lee is the director of the Cellular Therapy and Cancer Immunotherapy Program at Nationwide Children's Hospital and the OSU Comprehensive Cancer Center, our James Cancer Hospital, and Solove Research Center. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Men trying to follow the advice on whether they should get screened for prostate cancer have been confused in the past, and the guidelines and physician recommendations keep changing. This week, a new analysis of data published in the Annals of Internal Medicine lends support for prostate testing, concluding that it can reduce a man's risk of dying by upwards of 32%. We're talking about prostate screenings and male sexual health today. Joining us by phone is Los Angeles-based urologist and author of the new book, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health, Dr. Dudley Danoff. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here.
What is a prostate test? What happens with that?
Well, it's a PSA. It's a protein which is produced both by normal prostate and cancerous prostate, produced more by prostate cancers, so therefore we use it as a screening blood test. Should be done in most men over 40. And any elevation of prostate-specific antigen, which is PSA, requires some attention.
Why has there been so much debate just in recent years over whether the PSA test is recommended or not?
Well, the problem is PSA is elevated by lots of things. It's elevated by inflammation, infection, a bowel movement, a digital rectal examination, a long bicycle ride on a hard seat. Lots of things elevate a PSA. Unfortunately or fortunately, prostate cancer is one of them. So it becomes controversial. And secondly, once we get a positive PSA, do we do a biopsy? And then once we do a biopsy, how aggressive are we in treating it if it is a prostate cancer? I mean, many prostate cancers are what I would call, as a urologist, benign cancers. People will die with them and not of them. So then it becomes the conundrum, how do we deal with the prostate cancers? So it becomes a very delicate discussion between patient and his physician, and for that reason, it has been very controversial.
Are the therapies, when you do decide to use a therapy for prostate cancer, are there a lot of side effects? Is it impactful?
good question. It depends. There are aggressive prostate cancers and those that are not aggressive. So about a third of our patients are in what we call our active surveillance group, in which we observe the prostate cancer, watch it to see if it becomes aggressive, and many of them don't require any treatment at all. We have young people with very aggressive treatment that need surgery, but I'm very happy to say that we have a way of doing the surgery and removing the prostate. We call it the Da Vinci robotic radical prostatectomy, nerve sparing, continence sparing. And that technique, I mean, I've been in practice for more than 30 years and have seen the evolution of this surgery from its crudest beginnings. And the Da Vinci approach, the laparoscopic robotic approach, is the biggest miracle that I've seen in my urologic career. So we're able to remove the prostate, preserve a man's potency, preserve his continence to almost 100%. So it is remarkable. You just got to get yourself in the right hands of a highly experienced robotic surgeon, and then there's very little to worry about.
What do you recommend? Where do you fall along? Would you rather know if somebody has prostate cancer? Or what do you recommend to your patients?
Well, I have been a great supporter of PSA, even during the years when the task force from the United States government recommended no screening. My mantra has always been, I'm not an ostrich. I want to know the facts. I want to have the opportunity to reason with myself, do my own personal research as a patient, discuss it with my urologist as to what is the meaning of the PSA, how aggressive should we be with the PSA, do I need a biopsy or don't I need a biopsy? I think information is power. And I think to deny something that's out there, even though it might be controversial, is not doing a justice to the patient.
You write that in the last 30 years, there's been a dramatic increase in the number of cases of prostate cancer. Is that just a reflection of the more testing that's been done?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, prior to the era of PSA, which goes back about 25 years, 80% of the people that I would see who I would diagnose with prostate cancer, mostly by a digital rectal exam, filling a stony hard prostate, about 80% of those people would be inoperable. In other words, prostate cancer, which is already spread outside the confines of the prostate itself.
Mm-hmm.
And since the era of PSA testing, I mean, this rarely do we see a non-operable prostate cancer. So the death rate in the post PSA era has been reduced worldwide about 40%. So it's not insignificant. I mean, there'll be estimated this year about 240,000 new cases of prostate cancer. The statistics that are available are only from 2013, 173,000 new cases with 28,000 deaths. So it is not an insignificant disease.
But it's not typically aggressive, right?
Well, you know, as a lawyer would say, what do you mean by typical? you know, look, if your prostate cancer is aggressive, that's 100% aggressive cancer for you.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, fewer cancers are aggressive. I mean, more prostate cancers are non-aggressive than are aggressive, but it's very, very difficult to stage them. We have ways by grading the cancer. In other words, after we do a biopsy, we look at it under the microscope. We give it something called a Gleason grade. We look to see if it's close to a normal-looking prostate or if it's a wild, amorphic cell that doesn't look anything like a prostate cancer cell. Those are the aggressive types. So there are ways that we can differentiate the aggressive from the non-aggressive, and we tailor the treatment to that individual patient accordingly.
Is prostate cancer preventable?
It really is not. The disease in terms of death from prostate cancer is preventable, and the key to that is early diagnosis. We have some young patients who have very aggressive tumors that slip through the cracks, but that is a minority of the patients. So we can't cure it, but we can sort of catch it early with screening and treat it at an early stage. I mean, African-American men, high cholesterol, a family member with prostate cancer, first-degree relative, those are predisposing factors. People do believe there is a genetic link, not like diabetes mellitus, but there appears to be a genetic link. So that's where we are, but we really can't prevent it.
And as far as, yeah, you just mentioned African-Americans, high cholesterol. Those are correlations. They found correlations, but they haven't made an absolute link.
No, there is no absolute link.
Yeah.
And the same would be true of a first-degree male relative. So you are more likely, if you have one relative, for example, you are 33% more likely than an average person of your age to get prostate cancer. So it's a link, but there's no direct correlation.
You talk about urologic diseases in your book as well, benign prostate hypertrophy.
wait, we call it BPH.
Yeah, or BPH. It's not related to prostate cancer. What is it?
Not at all. So for your listening audience, it's just to paint a visual picture of what a prostate is. So if the urinary bladder is visualized as a balloon, which is upside down, the prostate's like a collar or a donut around the neck of the balloon. And as a man gets older, the donut gets bigger and the hole in the donut gets smaller. So he empties his bladder less efficiently. It gets in the way of urination, slow urination, getting up at night, incomplete bladder emptying, trickling, prone to infection. Those are not signs of prostate cancer. Prostate cancer in general is a silent disease. Those are old man's symptoms of an enlarged prostate, BPH, prostatic hypertrophy. That's the tutorial 101 in 30 seconds.
Is it pretty common?
Very. All men have some degree of BPH. You know, whether they're impacted by it or not, as the donut grows and the hole gets smaller, it becomes more difficult to urinate. But there are extremely effective treatments, mostly medications, that have revolutionized our treatment of BPH. But get checked. I mean, for your listeners, I certainly recommend every man over 40 to get an annual rectal exam, PSA testing, maybe a prostatic ultrasound. And it's tough to get the men to do that. You know, a woman would miss her yearly pap smear and her mammogram or breast examination. But the machismo of our male counterparts in Ohio, and I know them well, You can't get them to the urologist.
Well, I mean, what's a prostate examination like? You said that isn't it just a blood test?
Well, it's a blood test, but it also is actually a physical examination.
Okay.
It's called a digital rectal exam. A digital rectal is not some computerized axial.
It's actually
machine.
A digital rectal exam, yeah.
So if done, you know, if done gently, look, it's unpleasant for most men. It's unpleasant for the doctor. You know, the patient's complaining. I say, what are you complaining? I'm doing 40 of these a day. I feel sorry for you, urologist. but it's very important. And I think if you take it with a bit of a sense of humor and you have a gentle touch and you communicate the necessity, you know, with a patient, we all understand it. We're all big boys. But it's really, really essential that it be done.
Steve in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Dudley Danoff, author of The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. Hi, Steve.
Hi. What countries have the lowest incidences of prostate cancer? Are some higher than others?
Yes, they are. Japan has the lowest, as far as I recall. Northern Europe has the largest. Interestingly, we talked a moment about its high prevalence of African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
You take the same genetic pool in African Africans, and the incidence of prostate cancer is very low. A lot of people think it's related, you know, to cholesterol and diet, lipids. It's pure conjecture, but it is an interesting observation.
Why is prostate cancer so prevalent? Why it's the most prevalent
in the United
in
States?
The United States?
A lot of people think it's diet related.
Okay.
So there is a very famous person by the name of Michael Milken who had prostate cancer as a very young man, which was essentially incurable. He's alive today, 20 years later, and he attributes it to what he calls the Michael Milken cancer diet, high tofu, high protein, no fats, no lipids. So, again, there's no controlled experiment, you know, that I can say with certainty, but it certainly is highly suggestive and promising.
Steve, thanks a lot for that call. What kind of tips do you give your patients to improve overall urologic health, if not diet?
Well, again, I think the same holds true for prostatic health as general health. I'm a great proponent of a vigorous exercise program. I'm a big proponent of the power of positive thinking. You know, don't get up in the morning with any negative thoughts. Go out there, you know, be aggressive, watch your diet, limited alcohol, certainly no drugs, cholesterol, low lipids, you know, no smoking. Smoking is, you know, the killer of killers. So anything that promotes good health promotes prostate health.
Harold in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi. Did Dr. Danoff just answer your question, Harold?
No.
Okay.
It's more specific for me than that, and thank you for having this program. I'm wondering about supplements like saw palmetto or dietary things like pawpaw fruit or anything along that line, juices like cranberry juice, anything that you think might be helpful or might be questionable but is considered helpful.
Well, I would say, Harold, in general, most of those supplements benefit the seller more than the buyer. There are some drugs that we use that have been approved by the FDA that are definitely beneficial, both in reducing the size of the prostate, the symptoms of BPH, and decreasing the incidence of prostate cancer. Now, of the supplements that you mentioned, salt palmetto chemically is very close to a drug that is produced approved by the FDA. Most of the other supplements have never been tested. You know, you need to do a double-blind study, but because they're generics and they can't be patented, nobody bothers to study them. So they can make any claim they want. But in general, my experience over the many years I've been practicing is they are worthless. Now, I say to my patients, look, probably they won't do you any harm, and if you believe in your heart of hearts that it helps you, take the stuff, but I think you're flushing your money down the toilet.
Okay.
A urologic expression.
Yeah. Something. Okay, Harold in Delaware, thank you for that call. You know, it sounds to me, you know, when we were talking earlier about the examination, the digital rectal exam and that kind of thing, we were chuckling and it was funny, but there is a serious issue with men's shyness about their genitalia, right?
You know, absolutely. And I talk about that so much in my book. You know, I wrote an earlier book, and the title of it was Penis Power, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. So I'm a mainstream urologic surgeon, Princeton, Yale, Columbia trained, and every time I would say the word penis, there would be a giggle and a laugh, and I would have to say, you know, get over it. The penis is a body part. It's to the urologist what an elbow would be to an orthopedist. This is the 21st century. So men are very, very shy talking about it. I mean, women talk about breasts, vaginas, pap smears, but you say penis.
Well, they didn't always. I mean, it's been a process.
It's crazy.
But, yeah.
It's crazy. So, yeah, you know, part of my goal, you know, as an author, as a teacher, as a surgeon, is, pardon the expression, is to, you know, get the penis out of the closet. You know, let's fess up, guys, that we're not macho. You know, we all want to catch, you know, the pass in the last minute of the Super Bowl, but, you know, get your screening done. And, you know, you've got families, you've got loved ones, you've got people that care about you. And it does, you know, PSA screening of prostate for prostate cancer saves lives. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Dr. Dudley Danoff, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Ann. Let's do it again.
Dr. Dudley Danoff, a Los Angeles-based urologist and author of the new book entitled The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The catastrophic flooding in Houston after Hurricane Harvey will take years to recover. The toll on human life has been relatively small there, but with the torrential downpouring of rain comes another often overlooked problem, and that is mold. Houston, now a city submerged and digging out, is the perfect breeding ground for fungal growth, and it could mean serious health implications in the future. Now Hurricane Irma is on the way to Florida. Joining us by phone is Massachusetts-based mold inspector and author of The Mold Survival Guide for Your Home and for Your Health, Jeff May. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Also joining us is Leanne Billings. She and her family became seriously ill from mold and chemical exposures after Hurricane Katrina. She co-authored the book Mold, The War Within, Lessons Learned from Katrina. Welcome to the show, Leanne.
Hi, Ann.
You were a victim of mold exposure from Hurricane Katrina. How did it present itself? Did it come on all at once? Was it a slow progression? What happened?
Well, we really didn't realize that we were ill until we were significantly ill. It just happens pretty much all at once for us, but for various people, it can be different. A lot of it depends on a person's immune system. What we didn't realize, and what I hope everybody walks away from your show understanding, is that there are high-risk groups. According to the CDC, certain groups of people are in high-risk groups, and that's one of the reasons that my family and I got ill, because we were all in one of those high-risk groups. And I can guarantee you the people down in Houston do not understand about high-risk groups. If you want, we can talk a little bit about the high-risk groups.
Why do you guarantee that they don't understand about that? What do you mean by that?
Well, the high-risk groups are people include people that have allergies and who can be on allergy medications such as nasal steroids and inhalers. And those people, you know, we walk around feeling really healthy. You know, We consider ourselves a healthy group of people. We just have allergies. But having those types of allergies makes you susceptible, more susceptible to mold exposure and the mycotoxins that the molds produce. And so that's why I'm saying people who consider themselves healthy are more susceptible. I was more susceptible because I was recovering from a recent major surgery, but I was a couple months away from having been in the surgery, and I was recovering, and I felt healthy and well. But again, I was very susceptible. Other groups that are susceptible are infants and children, because they don't have fully developed immune systems, people who are elderly, pregnant women. Those are all people that can be healthy and not realize that they're in this high-risk group category. People who have weakened immune systems, organ transplants, things like that, those people understand they're at high risk. But the large population of people that consider themselves healthy can also be in that high-risk group, and that's where we fell in.
You know, we're up here in Bone Dry, Ohio right now, but a lot of people have friends and family down in Florida, Texas, and down into the, you know, the islands. So I'm wondering what you wish you had known about how to prepare for that particular kind of disaster when it came to mold.
Well, what people need to know is if they're in a high-risk group is to leave the remediation to other people,
okay,
and not to go into the area until where they're going to be living and working has been remediated and has been clearance tested. Other people from other areas in the country will also be flooding in to help these areas, which is wonderful, but they also need to assess themselves to see if they're in a high-risk group. And also, before someone leaves their area, say someone up in Ohio, they have a wonderful big heart and they want to go down and help.
Yeah.
They need to go down to a big box store, pick up a P100 respirator, put it on, and see if they can breathe sufficiently okay with that, because that's the type of protection that they should be wearing if they're going to go into a disaster area and be helping with that type of work. If they cannot breathe easily with the P100 respirator on, then they need to check with their doctor and discuss their health limitations. They may not be a good candidate to go down and help in the disaster area itself.
Jeff May, Massachusetts-based mold inspector and author of the book, The Mold Survival Guide for Your Home and for Your Health. When you hear about something like Harvey and upcoming Irma, you know, your heart, I'm sure you visualize all sorts of horrible things the rest of us would rather not know about.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I guess, you know, there's one thing that I'd like to sort of also to, you know, to reiterate what Leanne said. And, you know, that is about the proper protection. I think, you know, you'll often see people who are involved in these kinds of disasters, you know, not professionals, but homeowners, and they have these surgical masks on, you know, that go around your ears. And, you know, the surgical mask is just, it's really to protect the patient from the doctor's breath.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't go into a situation like that without wearing either an N95 or a P100 half face respirator. The even the, you know, the double strap masks that are N95, they're kind of, you know, they're leaky. So, and even being outside, you can have very, very high mold exposures. So anybody in that environment should be wearing, during cleanup anyway, should be wearing that type of protection, just being in the environment, period.
Why is it with situations like Hurricane Sandy, Katrina, and we're expecting Harvey, why is the mold so much worse? There's mold all over the place all the time, isn't there? What makes this so much worse?
Well, I guess, you know, it's the high humidity and the dampness. You know, these things can develop in a matter of days, and all the walls, the ceilings can be covered with mold. And you know, one tip. I mean, again, you know, Leanne was saying professionals should do it, but I think in a lot of cases, you know, people are going to end up doing it themselves.
Right.
And when mold is wet, the spores don't really get aerosolized much, and so you know, if things have dried out, it's important that they be dampened again. Maybe, you know, spray with some detergent solution so that it's wet, and then there's really not much aerosolization. If you go around tearing moldy walls down, you have, you know, huge exposures.
And all things being equal, you need to tear the walls down once there's mold?
Well, I would say that if walls have been soaked through and furniture's been soaked through, they just really have to be taken away. I mean, there's mold growth in wall cavities where things don't dry out quickly enough. That can be in ceiling cavities. And really, one of the most serious exposures, and again, this is something that I would probably emphasize, is because I've seen this a number of times, where just basements have flooded, and people have hot air heating systems, and water gets into the air conditioning or the hot air heating system, and these things have fibrous insulation in them, and when that insulation, which is always dirty, gets wet, it gets moldy, and people, they can clean this entire house out and be left with a duct system or heating or cooling system that's completely full of mold, and they have no idea.
Leanne Billings, you wrote that that doctors could not heal you and your family. Why not? How did you recover?
Well, the frustrating thing about becoming ill from mold exposure is there's so many components to it. It's not like being sick from a bacterial infection where we can get a pill and get better. There are antifungal pharmaceutical medications, but not everybody reacts and responds well to them, which is what was the situation with our family. The antifungal medication actually kills the fungal cells, which sounds good, but human cells are very, very similar to fungal cells. So along with killing the fungal cells, the antifungal medication also kills some of the human cells. So it's not a medication that should be taken unless it's absolutely necessary. And even then, the patient may not respond well. So what we encourage people to do is look at all the avenues of treatments, talk to your doctor about your health history, and then make a joint decision on which route of treatment that the doctor and the patient feels would be the first, best first route to try. Many people have to try many different treatments before they're going to find one that will successfully recover their health.
Jeff May, you made the salient point that for a lot of people, they're going to have to move. They're going to have to do the reclamation themselves. They're going to have to remediate themselves. For several reasons, probably one of which is there's just not enough people who are professionals in mold removal and remediation to go around, right?
Right. Sure.
I mean, I imagine people like you are headed down to Texas.
Possibly. I don't do remediation.
Uh-huh.
You know, I just do investigate
inspection,
sick buildings. So I wouldn't be going down. Plus, I'm allergic to mold.
Oh.
I wouldn't want that exposure.
Yeah, I guess not.
You know, I'm very careful. I mean, I most of the buildings that I investigate, I have to wear a mask. So, but it does, it's very helpful for people.
You know, I've always wondered, I mean, it just seems like there must be a lot of different kinds of molds out there. I went into an old bookstore one time, and I had to turn around and walk out. I couldn't figure out what hit me, and it had to have been mold now that I know more. How many molds are out there?
Well, there's there's lots of them, but I mean, the most common ones are in indoors, are Cladosporium, Aspergillus, and Penicillium. And, under some circumstances where it's really wet, you get that, black mold, Stachybotrys. But in my experience, if you could eliminate all the Aspergillus type molds from indoors, you'd probably get rid of 80% of the indoor air quality problems. I mean, it's a huge player in people's health. And I guess there's one very important point that I would like to make, and that is that, there's different kinds of sampling. Most people now do the kind of sampling for spores. It's called spore trap samples. And you look at samples by microscopy, and very often they'll say, your indoor concentration is less than your outdoor concentration, so, you're fine. But the big difference is this, and as I said, I've looked at 35,000 samples now. The indoors, if you get, let's say you have 10 spores of Penicillium indoors, and they're in a single chain because that's the way they grow, and there's 20 spores outside, but they are all individual spores. Even though the inside number or count is half, you still have a problem because it's in a chain. So if anybody is getting lab testing done for indoor problems, they should always get a lab that specifies whether the spores are in chains or clusters, because the Penicillium aspergillus spores rarely occur in clusters outdoors, very, very rarely. So no matter how few you have, if you have chains and clusters, you've got a problem.
Leanne, you have a background in journalism, and after you were exposed to the mold from Katrina, you went out and interviewed experts in science and medicine to find out more. What surprised you as a layperson in your findings?
Well, with my background in journalism, I knew just to put my recorder on, my headset on, and I printed out, with my husband, we printed out the published peer-reviewed studies on mold, because the doctors that were treating us back at that time did not know anything about mold. We were evacuated up into Montana, and it took them a while to figure out we were even ill from mold. So by the time I got on the phone with all the principal investigators who were MDs and PhDs, they directed me to their studies, and they explained their studies. They broke it down into lay language so I could understand it. And I guess what surprised me most is that nobody's really talking about it. We have mold in our schools. We have mold in our homes. And it's not very well understood at how there can be a direct correlation between allergies, asthma, the health effects that we're feeling that are causing us to become ill on a regular basis, how that can be caused by mold, structural mold, in someone's home or workplace. And I think that connection just isn't being made in the general public arena until somebody becomes significantly sick.
Mm-hmm.
During a hurricane, you can become sick more quickly in a disaster area, but in your home or your school or your workplace, it can come on you more gradually. The mycotoxins or the poisons that are released from molds, what they do is they lower the immune system. So a person's immune system becomes, you know, lower and lower, and they become more susceptible until they, you know, finally figure out that there's a correlation. When they're outside of that building, they feel better.
But they can only find a correlation. They can never say definitively this caused that with mold.
Published peer-reviewed studies are coming up with information.
Okay.
Mayo Clinic, back in 1999, they did studies and that proved that the majority of fungal sinusitis, chronic sinusitis infections are caused by fungus. So there's a lot of published peer-reviewed studies. The MDs and PhDs that are doing this work are doing a great job. It's just not filtering its way down to the general public, so the general public understands what's making them ill.
Leanne Billings, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Leanne Billings is the author of Mold, The War Within, Lessons Learned from Katrina. Also, Jeff May, thanks to you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Jeff May is Massachusetts-based mold inspector and author of the book, The Mold Survival Guide for Your Home and for Your Health. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, the All Sides interns Kyle McKinnon, Courtney Gilbert, and Martin Coleman, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks so much for listening today. It's been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.